This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for joining. We've been talking about these large truck driver protests in Canada that are causing major disruptions here in Detroit because of the blockade of the Ambassador Bridge. And we're asking this critical question. Is this the right way to protest? Is there such a thing as a right or a wrong way to protest? And how do we define what's legitimate political discourse and what's unacceptable disruption? That exact phrase, legitimate political discourse, happens to be what the Republican Party used recently in an official statement to describe the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol last year. Quote, legitimate political discourse. Is that really how we should describe a violent riot that was a direct attempt to block the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimate presidential election? And if that's not okay, what are some of the other ways that we see people protesting that aren't okay? I tend to think that we see these things through the lens of our own politics. When people are protesting something that we agree with, we tend to think that, well, it's okay to do anything because they're sticking up for their rights. But when they're protesting something that we disagree with, we tend to think, hey, why don't the cops get involved? Why don't they stop this? These are questions at the heart of our interaction and discussions in this country right now. And I think they're more critical because there are so many things that so many people are really worked up about right now. 20 years ago, I doubt you would have seen the number of people show up in Washington who did last January 6th. 20 years ago, I doubt you would have seen the number of protesters that we saw during the Black Lives Matter protests a few years ago out in the streets. Everybody's a little on edge about their rights and making sure that they're respected. But where do we draw the lines between sticking up for those rights, being part of the discourse, and disrupting just for the sake of disruption? That's what we want to explore for the rest of the hour, where those lines are, who gets to draw them, and how we, even as a divided society, decide how to come up with solutions out of all of these interactions. We've got a great guest with us to help us unpack all of that. Timothy Schaefer is director of Kansas State University's Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy. He's also director of Civic Engagement and Deliberative Democracy for the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and he's associate editor for the Journal of Deliberative Democracy. Timothy Schaefer, welcome to Detroit Today.
Well, hey, thanks so much. It's wonderful to be with you. And I think, as you were just mentioning, it's such a salient question for all of us, not just a bunch of academics.
Yeah, yeah. So we've been talking about these protests in Canada against vaccine mandates. Of course, that's a different country with slightly different laws and norms that surround political discourse. But I'm curious about what you make of what's happening here. This is a blockade that, of course, is disrupting a big part of the local economy. It will very soon, if it goes on, disrupt the national economy in both countries. Is this, in your mind, a legitimate way for these truckers to make the point that they're making?
Well, I mean, as you noted, right, it has seemingly moved from a very localized kind of experience of this blockade to something that is very soon, if not already, having these ripple effects across both of these countries, right, potentially for kind of a long time for kind of the trade between countries and just manufacturing. I mean, realizing the kind of ecosystem, I think, as we've seen with COVID more globally, too, is we're all connected in ways that we have to really acknowledge that, as some of that shapes maybe how we address some of these kinds of concerns. So you know, more pointedly to your question, is this legitimate? I would step back and say, how do we, as you said a few minutes ago, how do we approach this and what are our politics? And that is a major factor in what determines if we see this as being, you know, something we align with and support because this is kind of the grassroots kind of democracy in practice, right? Or is this just utter disruption and they're challenging these things? We could flip this on a whole host of issues. But I want to be really careful, importantly, because not just to turn this about this other side sort of orientation. One of the important ways to think about this, and it was in the argument that Jen Mercia and I made in an essay out just a few days ago about this legitimate political discourse, trying to create some space between them. And one argument is, are we making arguments that we're trying to persuade people to our views? And are we doing that kind of in good faith in a way that is giving people those opportunities to do so? Or are we kind of confronting and using coercion, right? This kind of confrontation, this violence, classic scholar Bernard Crick talked about this. Why do we have politics? Well, it's a lot better than war. And so not to conflate these things. And so when we think about something like protest, it is by design supposed to be disruptive, right? This is why we have blockades on streets, marches and such. Conversation a long time ago, a scholar wrote, is not the soul of democracy. There are moments we have to break out of that and kind of scream, whether it's Black Lives Matter, other scenarios. You know, so when we think about social movements and strikes and demonstrations, they all fall kind of within that window. The challenge, though, as you've noted, is that these things can have real and kind of crippling effects, not just economically, which is very real. And for many people, this is, and I'm sure where you're sitting is being felt immensely, right? Because you're literally seeing it and experiencing it. Mm-hmm. But also when we think about, like, what are the potential implications? I think about, I might get the language wrong here, but the Bridgegate in New Jersey, when that was going on a number of years ago, and when they found that was done for a political reason, the first thought that I have is not people being grumpy that they're backed up to get to work in that morning, but I'm thinking about the person who dies in an ambulance because they're unable to get down the highway to the hospital in time because it's being done in such a way. And so I bring a little bit of that to this question, right? To what end? What are the implications? So is it not just that GM can get parts across this bridge, or can we get agricultural products or whatever it might be? Those are all really important. So I don't want to dismiss that. But when we start to think about the real effect and the impact on people's lives, this is where it becomes a real question, right? And how do we make the statements that we're making with also acknowledgement that we're trying to get people to see this? Maybe the last point on this is, what is this doing? To what end is always my question. And by all indications, our politics right now, because we're so deeply enrooted in what we refer to as affective polarization, right, that we see that other side as not just people with a different set of policy views, say about tax policy or marginal rates or whatever it might be, but we really see them as enemies and we need to beat them. We need to win, right, at all costs. And we're seeing that play out here in the States as we're redrawing maps and such, right? If we're not playing the game fairly, then that's a real loss for democracy writ large. So it moves away from just a kind of a left, right, or a certain party, even if we're talking in Canadian politics, right, or US. But that sense of, do we have the ability to see ourselves as something bigger, as a larger collective? What is our responsibility? And if COVID is, in this experience for the last couple of years, has indicated anything, we've really struggled with that larger sense of identity. We're very fractured, and we break along some of these lines that political identity has come to dominate virtually every other category that has in the past defined people, whether it was religion or region, education, all these kinds of things fall way down the list now. And politics is that primary factor that all of a sudden I can figure out, you drive this car, you eat this food, you go to this grocery store, I know who you are. And that's a real problem for democracy, whether we're talking about in the United States, in Canada, or really elsewhere.
So one of the things I want to really drill down on is the method, I guess, that we would use to judge the legitimacy of a certain course of action or protest. So to me, just looking at it without thinking about the politics that are involved, this bridge blockade doesn't look terribly different from the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama in the 1960s. And, you know, this is something that we used for many years in the civil rights movement here in the United States. This method of disruption to bring attention and to put pressure. And I said it was in the 1960s. Of course, the Montgomery bus boycott is in the mid 1950s. But the only way to distinguish between that and what these truckers are doing is through a political lens, right? I support civil rights. I support the idea that African Americans should be treated like everybody else, have the same access to do things. And so I support the idea of the Montgomery bus boycott. I don't support the idea that people should run around and not be vaccinated. I think that's a public health threat, first of all. And so I don't support what these truckers are doing. But that leads us back to this intractable situation where I just don't see the other side, right? I don't acknowledge their rights as being as important or as worthy of protection as my own. Why is that? Is that the right way to think about it, or is that the wrong way to think about it?
Well, I think it's a great question and a really good point. And another way to, you know, maybe add to that and think about this is also what happens to the ACLU on occasion, that by default, many people think about it as kind of categorically falling on a certain end of the spectrum, if you want to use that language. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they show up and they're supporting and providing counsel and such to somebody who seemingly is not on that end of that political spectrum. And for some people, that's a really like jarring moments to realize, why are you defending this kind of view, right? So often under the umbrella of kind of the free speech arguments. And it does, right? I mean, if we were to strip away either color or time or place, right? If all of a sudden we make this, use pseudonyms, for example, right? And we're not talking about the bridge there, right? We're not talking about the Ambassador Bridge. We're not talking about Montgomery. We're not using some of those things that very clearly mark these moments in time that we kind of culturally, like, quote, know how to think about some of this. And if we do that, this is a real challenge, right? And it goes back to, I guess, a little bit of my comment earlier is what's coming from this, right? And arguably the bus boycotts, and sitting in the counters and the like, right? That was very disruptive. It was amazingly jarring to people's lives. And you could say something akin to that about these truckers and this blockade. An important distinction to make here is not just that, you know, can those ambulances get where they need to go? Because that's kind of an extreme form of this. But it's also a question of who within society are the ones raising their voices? Who are the ones that are kind of breaking outside of the decorum or that civil discourse, if you want to use that language? And are screaming, right, and saying, "Here we are, and here's your movements, your strikes, your demonstrations, and the like." And if it's those who are most marginalized in society, for whatever reasons, whether it's economically, mm-hmm. Racially, and such, it seems that there's an opportunity for that to be seen as more legitimate because they are kind of on the fringes, so to speak. But if we changed our language a little bit, we can very quickly see how some of these people who would, you know, be identified as being white, maybe predominantly male, right? The trucking industry is not exclusively male, but, you know, heavily dominated in those ways, right? Ideologically to the right, right? So all of a sudden, it starts to tick a different set of boxes. And I think that's maybe subconsciously a little bit of what makes a little space between these is, you know, what are the differences between Black Americans in 1958, for example, versus a white Canadian in 2022, right? The necessity here of going kind of out of these boundaries, but it does speak to, I think, some of these other layers of trust in systems and senses of identity and that notion of kind of the common good, right? Yeah. Again, it's what are we being asked to do, right? Am I being asked to have my humanity recognized and be seen as part of that political and cultural system? Am I being asked to, you know, to do potentially something that is in the collective good, right? I.e., there's truly a novel virus that has not existed in our world before, and we're confronting this not just, you know, because of political geo kind of political boundaries, but all of this, right? All of these things are real, and as we know it, right? And as information continues to develop, thank you, science, right? In those senses. But that ability to say, what are we being asked to do? Am I giving up my kind of agency and autonomy? Or am I, you know, potentially being frustrated with some of this? And I think those are those places where we can start to maybe pull these apart a little bit, the way that you have set it up, because we really do need to think about what are my obligations to others, even when that becomes uncomfortable. And that's what brings us to a bunch of truckers who are saying, I need to recognize, have that recognized for me as well, for X, Y, and Z reasons. Yeah.
But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about reasonable discourse and the lines that we draw between that and disruptive things that we need to have the authorities crack down on. We want to hear more from you on the phones and on social media. Stan in Royal Oak, Ward L in Detroit, Maryland, and Oak Park, Derek in Detroit. We will get to you next. You can also go to social media, Facebook and Twitter, for comments there, and we can include you. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
Bringing you news that matters.
Stories that impact your life.
Music from the Motor City and around the world.
This is 101.9 WDET.
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Detroit Today. I'm Stephen Henderson, and my guest is Timothy Schaefer, director of Kansas State University's Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy. We're talking about the lines around civil discourse, reasonable discourse in our country. Are we in a place where those lines are changing, where we're reconsidering what's legitimate expression or protest and what's not? We want to hear from you as well. 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter and put comments there, and we'll try to work those into the conversation. I want to start with Wardell in Detroit this time. Wardell, tell us what you're thinking.
Okay, and I try to make this quick, but I think you're having the right discussion. And I think it's a very good discussion to have. But I think when it gets to the point, like in Canada, when you're affecting the lives of everyday people, you know, it's not just the authority or whatever that is, when actually people cannot get to emergency, somebody get to the hospital, somebody's house is on fire, emergency equipment can't come through, then I think you have to say it's gone too far. And I think one way to deal with, because Trump intervened for Black Lives Matter, and Obama brought out the demolition crew to get rid of Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. So things can be done when they go, when it's considered extreme or nothing. To me, it wasn't that extreme. But I think the most humane way to do it is to, and I'm saying this as a peaceful protester myself, I think the most humane way to do it is to figure out the right amount of tear gas that you can put out there that will scare the people without injuring them. I think that can resolve the issue. It's a certain amount that you can use to get people away. At the same time, nobody dies or gets sick.
Wow. Wardell, that frightens me a little, thinking about how we define what you're talking about. But I think the sentiment there makes a lot of sense in terms of how you want to keep some disruptions to a minimum. I really appreciate the call and the comments, though. Before we get back to our guest, I want to get to Stan in Royal Oak. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I agree with some of the comments of Wardell. If ambulances were being stopped or fire trucks were being stopped, but I don't think there's evidence of that here. If those things were happening, I think it crosses the line. I want to say, first off, I disagree profoundly with their cause, the people who are blocking the bridge. However, I had to stop and think. I was involved in a very disruptive protest in college where we took over the building that housed the registrar's office and the cashier, and people couldn't get their transcripts. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of protests. Thoreau first talked about, as far as I know, on civil disobedience. Gandhi took it and ran with it, and of course Martin Luther King used it. And as you pointed out earlier, those protests were disruptive. But in all civil disobedience, and Thoreau made this point, and Martin Luther King Jr. made this point, part of it is a willingness to go to jail for breaking the law. I don't know how you disrupt this peacefully. Tear gas wouldn't be my first way of doing it. Trying to force them out of the trucks and moving the trucks, yes, and jailing them. They have to be willing, if you're going to commit civil disobedience, you have to be willing to pay the price. That was all part of Thoreau's and King's and Gandhi's philosophy.
Yeah. Stan, I love that you called and shared your thinking about this. I think that nuance, that kind of parsing of the really finer points of this is really, really important. Quickly, I want to get to Adrian before we get back to our guest. Adrian in Detroit, go ahead.
Good morning, Stephen.
Hey.
Henderson, I want to tell you, I love how you phrased that question, tell me if I'm wrong. And because we always assume we're right. So when you tell your guest, am I wrong? Tell me if I'm wrong and let me see your point. But also, I have to say, what is best for the greater good? Those truckers have rights, but it is infringing on everyone else's rights. So when do we say your rights are okay, we agree with that, but now you're denying everyone else their rights? It is the right of the greater good, what helps the greater good, not only the truckers, but everyone else.
Yeah. Adrian, that's a really interesting way to try to think of these kinds of disruptions and to evaluate them. Timothy Schaefer, react to not just what Adrian was talking about, but our other callers as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to actually have a longer cup of coffee with the three of them. So, I mean, thanks for those comments. And I think they all really speak to the heart of this, the tensions between part of what makes a democratic society a democratic society is that we can do these things, right? This sense of peaceable assembly is baked into our First Amendment, right? When we talk about the freedoms of religion and press and speech and such. And so, but the last caller, you know, just to jump on a little bit of that point is really, I mean, really this tension, right? What trumps, that's not a pun here, but like,
right.
What is it that we privilege? Is it the individual or is it the community, right? And so, you know, there's a classic text, John Dewey, in a book called The Public and Its Problems. He kind of talks about this. It says, you know, democracy, you know, paraphrasing slightly here, but like democracy is primarily a way of thinking about community life. And only secondary is it this kind of sense of like what the state does, right? The state functions, actions, you know, i.e. government. And so The wrestling with some of these questions are at the heart of what it means to be here instead of someplace else. And if you've been, or anybody listening has been paying attention, watching the Olympics, it's always for me that striking moment. Right now, it's happening in China, for example, and thinking about what it means to be a citizen in a place. And that's not just this kind of ticket to kind of have my own agency and kind of function without any regard for others around me, because we're part of an ecosystem, right? And a political cultural ecosystem is a really important one to recognize. And if we don't kind of acknowledge the real expectation and requirement that comes with that, then I think we find ourselves in this spot that if we're just a bunch of little kind of atoms bopping around without seeing that we're part of this larger effort, this thing that kind of sticks together. And right, as one of the earlier callers said, right, this is not quite, I don't think, right? And this would be a good question, right? Are there people who are being impeded in ways that are, you know, so severe that it's affecting their lives?
Right.
The livelihood question is different, but it's really related, right? I think the first caller, whose name I'm not recalling at this moment, really said a good point. The sense of everyday people, this is where it really starts to matter. So there are protests and things that can be dramatic, significant, right? Million Man March and all sorts of things, whether it's in Washington or elsewhere. But those are being done in certain ways that they're speaking to authorities, right? They're speaking to power.
Right.
We're in front of the legislature or the White House or wherever it might be. Choose other countries the same way, right? Showing up in capitals and the like. It's another thing to be thinking about some of this literally, and we've seen it for the last number of years, right? In streets, in the ways that people can literally get to their places. If I can't ride on public transport, and that's the way I get to my place of employment, and I can't feed my children or do things in that respect, then we got a real problem. This is where I think we have to continue to push and ask those questions. How do we live together? How do we live well? And that's our real challenge, whether we're Canadian or American.
Tim Schaefer of the Kansas State University's Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy. It's really great to have you here to help us think this through. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
That's going to do it for us today. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to talk about Governor Gretchen Whitmer's ambitious new budget proposal for us here in Michigan. And Detroit's new official historian, Jamon Jordan, is going to join to talk about his new position, Black History Month, and to bust a couple of myths about Black history in Detroit. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.